Puranjana Puranjana
Puranjana Puranjana
Arjun Hare Hare Dire Tatra
Arjun Hare Dire Tatra
Pratya Shedhatra Chagraha
Pratya Shedhatra Chagraha
All of them.
All of them.
Chandavega.
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 Anucharaha.
Anucharaha.
Followers.
Followers.
Puranjana.
Puranjana.
Of King Puranjana.
Of King Puranjana.
Puram.
Puram.
City.
City.
Yada.
Yada.
When.
When.
Hartum.
Hartum.
To plunder.
To plunder.
Are dire.
Are dire.
Tatra, there. Praja Sedha, defended. Prajagaraha,
the
big serpents.
Serpent.
Translation and purport by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. When King Gandharva Raja Chandavega and his followers began to plunder the city of Puranjana, a snake with five hoods began to defend the city. Purport. When one is sleeping, the life air remains active in different dreams. The five hoods of the snake indicate that the life air is surrounded by five kinds of air known as prana, apana, vyana, udana, and samana. When the body is inactive, the prana or the life air is active. Up to the age of 50, one can actively work for sense gratification. But after the 50th year, one's energy decreases, although one can, with great strain, work for two or three more years, perhaps up to the 50th year. Thus, the 55th year is generally taken by government regulations as the final year for retirement. The energy, which is fatigued after 50 years, is figuratively described herein as a serpent with five hoods. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunivadi Paspasya Vijitakane. So I found it interesting that Srila Prabhupada says in the purport that up to the age of 50, one can actively work for sense gratification. But after the 50th year, one's energy decreases, although one can, with great strain, work for two or three more years, perhaps up to the 55th year. In today's world, at least in America, people can't really retire and get Medicare and all of that until they're 66. So some people say that the today 60 is the new 50, or 50, you know, people either are living longer or they have no money or whatever, but they don't retire and they keep upping that. It used to be 65, now it's 66. So by Vedic standards, that's about 16 years older than what is recommended for a person to give up the comforts of living at home. And in Vedic culture, this instruction to give up the comforts of home in one's later years is exactly the opposite to what people in materialistic cultures are recommended. Most people, if you notice, who are working in the material world, they work very hard, saving up a whole bunch of money, and so-called investments and security measures. So as soon as they retire, if they live that long, they can enjoy. They're looking at perspective. They're holding it 30, 40 years, they're working very hard. 50 years, they're working very hard. With the hopes that when they retire, then they will enjoy life. And often what I've noticed is that people will cross that threshold. They finally can retire. They start reaping social security. And then they find out they have a terminal illness like cancer. It's a very shocking thing. They have been hoping for rest and relaxation, but instead they have to deal with a health issue. Prabhupada says other places in his books that a person should spend the last 20 years of their life, if they've absorbed themselves in materialistic endeavors the first part of their life, they should at least have the last 20 years of their life working or absorbing themselves in Krishna consciousness, particularly if they've been busy their whole life in fruitive activities. But who knows when those last 20 years will be? I mean, it could be when you're 15. Right? It could be when you're 10 years old. So although Prabhupada, you know, in a natural order where people are living a certain amount of time and they may live till 80, 90 years old, you have this 20 years, there's no guarantee that we're going to be, we're going to have those last 20 years. In a room conversation that I heard of Srila Prabhupada, he explains that this advancement of civilization, instead of utilizing the valuable form of human life, there is always wasting. And at night they are sleeping, and at noon they are playing football. You see them wasting their time. By so-called sporting life, 20 years passed, 50 years spent in sleeping, and 20 years by football. Then that's 70 years passed, and when a person is an old man, then there's pain. There's rheumatism, and there's so many, and he stops to get the word diabetes and so on. So by treatment, and this treatment, that treatment, blood examination, another 20 years goes by, and you can practically see people in my generation. I just turned 67, so you know, in my generation, materialistic people or non-materialistic people often have health issues that they are spending a lot of time trying to manage. So that may go on for 20, 30 years beyond now if they live till 90 years old. Prabhupada himself, interestingly enough, had also diabetes. I didn't know this until just recently. He didn't really treat it. He would eat whatever he wanted to eat. He didn't want to be a doctor das. But he had the attitude, I noticed, that let me die fighting on the battlefield, fighting to save suffering humanity. Because death is sure. In one way or another, we're going to die anyway. There's no escaping that. You can live a little bit longer. You might live a little bit more pleasantly in this way, that way. But in the end, we're going to die. In his purport to the Bhajan Raymana, Prabhupada explains, Kamala Dala Jala Jivana Talamala. What assurance of real happiness is there in all one's wealth, youth, sons, and relatives? This life totters like a drop of water on a lotus petal. Therefore, you should always worship the lotus feet of Lord Hari. He explains further that Kamala Dala Jala means the lily flower. And he says, you've all seen lily flowers on the lakes. They are tottering, always in the water, tottering. At any time, it can be overflooded. And similarly, this life is full of danger always, always in danger. Any moment can be finished. There are so many instances. People see it, they understand it, but they forget. And that's the wonderful thing, that people are seeing that every day, every moment, that there is danger, and others are in danger, but they are busy ignoring this reality. Still they are thinking, I am secure. This is the position. So life is very tottering, and we are in a dangerous position. Therefore, one should take advantage of this human form of life and immediately engage in Krishna consciousness. That should be the request of everybody in their own mind. My dear mind, please don't drag me into the dangerous position. Please keep me in Krishna consciousness. In my training as a chaplain, there's a book that is required reading called The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. And he wasn't really a devotee, but he had studied. He was smart enough to study the culture, the materialistic culture. And he could plainly see that underlying the efforts of human society is trying very hard to deny or forget that we are all going to die. That is the sum and substance. He writes a whole book about in so many ways. If you study society, you will see it's really all an effort to deny or forget that we are dying. And if you say this to someone who is in a materialistic consciousness, if you just point that out, they will roll their eyes and tell you that you're thinking negatively. Don't be so negative. This is the reality.
Why is that a negative?
That's a good piece of information. It's actually a positive realization, because if you know that you are dying any minute, you can switch your priorities to utilize your moments all the time. But often people say, you're obsessed with death. What is up with you people? That you all the time have to bring that piece in. That's a sad reality. We don't want to think about it until we're dying. So we are all pretty ignorant, even as devotees. You know, we know that theoretically that we're dying. We read it all the time, we study it all the time, but in reality, we're forgetting that fact. Because if you sit stunned that I could die the next moment, you probably would just sit down and chant all the time. Hey, that would be a great idea, or yes, sing all the time, or study Prabhupada's books all the time. What a good idea! We're actually sitting in God's waiting room. If you've ever been in a doctor's office, and the receptionist calls up, next, next, and we're just sitting here. Wherever we are, we're waiting for that receptionist of Krishna to call our number. You're next, it's your time. It used to be that people followed all the religious principles for cultivating spiritual consciousness very strictly. Prabhupada explains that in Sakya Yuga, religious principles were followed 100%. Pretty much every activity in a person's daily life was done as an offering to Krishna, such that people were always, in all their activities, remembering their connection to God. And they were also following the four regulative principles, which was considered to be normal in life. It was kind of the norm. Everyone followed them. It was abnormal not to. So what are those regulative principles? We all have to promise to follow them when we take initiation. Let's just for our memory, what are they?
Gambling and intoxication.
Everybody used to follow all of those. That was just sort of a social norm. But as time passed, time started to degrade Satya Yuga, people started to follow these religious principles less and less. For example, in Treta Yuga, people followed religious principles only, Prabhupada says, 25% of what they did in Satya Yuga. So that means people were following 75% religious principles and 25% irreligious principles. And then in the next stage, in Dwapara Yuga, people spent 50% of their time practicing religious principles and 50% of their time engaged in irreligious activities. And in our current Kali Yuga age, Prabhupada explains that 75% of people's times, and I would say it's probably even more than 75% if you study what people are doing with their time, 75%, if not more, of their time is spent in irreligious activities, and 25%, probably more than that, of their time is spent in religious activities. Probably less than 25%. Not many people are very keen on practicing spiritual life. They may go to church, they may, you know, go to some mosque or temple, they go, they're sleeping in church or not listening. There are very, very few people. And I have had the privilege and the challenge of training all kinds of religious leaders, from imams in the Sufi tradition, imams in the Orthodox tradition, Jewish, various varieties of Jewish traditions, Christians, priests, and Protestants, and yes, they know somehow or other that we're eternal, but they don't live like it. They live that they're going to die. That's an unsavory truth. So Prabhupada said, then there will be devastation when we get to the point where no one is practicing any religious principles at all. And then everything will be devastated, and then again, the cycle of Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali Yuga will happen. Prabhupada explains that the duration of Satya Yuga is about 1,800,000 years. And in Treta Yuga, it lasts about 1,200,000 years. And in Dwapara Yuga, it lasts about 800,000 years. And he said that Kali Yuga will last for about 400,000 years. So right now, we are at the beginning of Kali Yuga. And out of those 400,000 of years, we've passed only about 5,000 years. It's just beginning. And it's so degraded already. Kali Yuga began after the battle of Kurukshetra ended, and so there's still a balance of 427,000, what is it? 427,000 of years. Still a balance. So just look at how much things have degraded in 5,000 years. Add to that another 10,000. I hope I don't take birth again to have to see that. I mean, it's going to get worse if you think it's bad now. And Prabhupada explains that in this age, the denial of death has so excessively increased that some of the scientists, they're working on how can they stop death altogether. There are actually people out there who are trying to figure out this problem. How can we stop dying? Sometimes scientists are experimenting with putting a body on ice and thinking, well, if you're very wealthy, you can pay into this bank and we will, when you die, put your body in a freezer, some kind of a coffin that's electrically frozen, and maybe in due course of time when we figure out how to bring you back to life, you will have another opportunity. I also heard once in a lecture, it wasn't a lecture of Prabhupada, but it was a lecture of doctors, some doctors, gerontology, the science of aging. And they were trying to figure out, well, if the cells are changing every 7 years, that some cells are dying, some cells are becoming new, then the problem of death really has to do with nutrition and exercise. That's really, you know, if we could just get people to eat a nutritious food and exercise properly, there would be no need to die because the body would just perpetually go on. So, of course, this is an illusion, but that's what people are working on because they're so afraid of death that they're practically willing to do almost anything to avoid facing this reality. You probably read the story of Prabhupada talking to a businessman or a businessman who had been diagnosed with a terminal illness. And the doctor said, oh, you only have a little bit more time to live. And so Prabhupada said, the businessman, he begged the doctor, can't you just extend my life another 4 years so I can finish my business endeavors? I have some business plans that I need 4 years more to complete. And Prabhupada thought, this was such a ridiculous proposal. You know, if you live another minute, you live another week, you live another 4 years. If you were to want to live longer at all, it wouldn't be to continue business plans. You know, it would be great to have more time to hear, chant, remember, and serve, but this is ridiculous. And on the other hand, you have people who are trying very hard to avoid the suffering that goes along with death or old age. They know I'm going to die sometime, but I have to have a strategy to avoid all the pain that sometimes goes along with the disease and the dying process. I've talked to even my mother who says, dying I don't mind. If I just die, that's nothing. But the getting to death, or the dying process, I'm so afraid of the pain of it. And of course, not everybody has that pain, but there's this anxiety around that. For example, some countries now, maybe even Australia, when I came here, someone mentioned they had legalized some, for some specific context, euthanasia. Is that true? Yeah. And I don't know if in America they have that. They're trying very hard to legalize a person's right to take some kind of medication, a cocktail of pharmaceuticals or drugs that they can take when they decide that it's getting too painful, and they can take some cocktail. I have seen on YouTube, if you want to research different people experimenting with this, people who have actually done it, many people have videotaped, you know, them at the end taking these tablets and why they take them and whatever, and some of the problems with that too. If you, you know, you take these euthanasia drugs and you don't completely die, I mean, you might be living for the next 50 years as a vegetable, which isn't a very good idea. Statistically, in the American population, there's the greatest area in human society in America has been assessed as elder men who don't want to be a burden on other people when they can no longer take care of themselves. It's kind of a statistic there in terms of suicide rate that particularly among elder men and some women, but mostly men, they feel very out of place when they can no longer work. They equate their personal value only by how much materially productive they are. And then they become depressed. So what is the point of living? I know my father suffered with that at a certain stage and used to tell us that when I get to be unable to take care of myself or do anything, I'm just going to walk into the forest and end it. But he never did it. He had dementia. Dementia. And at a certain point, my sister said, "Dad, this is the moment. Walking, you can't even walk. I walk into the forest." So recently, my 91-year-old mother, who thinks about death a lot now because all of her friends have died, all of her family practically, she's the one person left standing. I think I mentioned it in another lecture. And she came across a newspaper article that she wanted me to see. And it was about a woman in her 90s who had decided 20 years before that that she would end her life when her life started to be too difficult to care for on her own, when she lost her independence. And she decided to do something that's now a thing in America called voluntary stopping eating and drinking. VSED, they call it. And by the way, this is a real thing. I mean, you can look it up on YouTube if you want to learn more about it. Basically, it's just exercising one's final freedom to end your life by just stopping eating and drinking. You know, forget the drugs, forget getting a doctor's permission. If you feel like you're ready to die, just stop eating and drinking. It's not very complicated. And so the woman decided that when her body started to fail, she would just stop that, stop eating and drinking. And so she asked her daughter. It came to the time where she was not able to walk very well. She had some kind of, nerve disorder. She needed now to live in an assisted living home, and she needed someone to care for her. So she reminded her daughter, 20 years ago I decided when it came to this, then I would end my life. And so she said, "I want you to record me in these stages so that other people can see it's not such a big deal, nothing to be afraid of." So the daughter said, it was really shocking that my mother, wanted me to do that. It's like, I didn't have any reason why we couldn't take care of her. We were her daughters, no problem. We loved her. She was a great mom. But we wanted to honor her wishes. So the daughter had to explain that at the beginning of the video. This is not my wish at all, that my mother should stop eating and drinking. It's only her wish. And I watched this video. It's online. It's 15 minutes. And the woman is telling in the beginning that this is my choice, and I'm actually looking forward to it. I'm not afraid. And this is a great alternative to what would be if I were to continue on in this disease that will progressively get worse. So apparently when her mother was trying to figure out how to strategically do this, to start, they had contacted many hospices to see if the hospices would be willing to take them under her care, her under their care, so that they could monitor this process. Hospice is mainly there for pain management, and because she couldn't remember dying another time, she didn't know if it was going to be painful or not. So she wanted to be sure somebody was there to monitor the pain and regulate it if she needed some medication for that. But the hospices said, "Well, we only take people who are diagnosed to only live another 6 months." So they kept looking. They were so determined and found one hospice that was able to or agreed to take her on because they knew if you stop eating and drinking, it only takes about 7-8 days if you really do it strictly. So they said, "Well, that fulfills our criteria because it's under 6 months." So they took her on, and on the first day, her mother got on the phone. That was her first strategy. "I'm going to get on the phone, and I'm going to say goodbye to everybody I know." And so the first day, second day, third day, she was busy chatting. She felt great. She was telling the camera, "I'm totally comfortable. I actually feel better because I'm not eating. After 3 days, you're fasting. If you're faster, you can have that experience, how much joy it is not to have all the brain in the stomach for all the food that you're eating. So she felt great, first day, second day, third day, fourth day, you know, chatting with people and telling everybody, this is great, you know, I'm in good shape. And on the fifth day, she woke up and she said, I'm experiencing a shift in my body. It's a little different. I'm really glad. I was wondering if this is going to go on forever, that I'm feeling great. I didn't feel like my body was making any changes. So on the fifth day, she said, she started to begin to experience her heart rate going up and some fatigue, which is obviously some symptoms of a body going under stress if you're not getting nourishment and whatnot. And but not a whole lot of pain. She was like, well, you know, it's shifting, but I'm not really feeling pain. And then on the sixth day, she became more drowsy. And she found out her lungs didn't, perhaps they were too dry. I don't know enough about science to know what was the reason, but she was having a little trouble to get air. I don't know, you're kind of into health, so maybe you know why that would be, maybe not having enough liquid. So the heart started to really pump harder to get enough air. So the hospice people jumped in and they gave a little morphine, which is what they do typically when a person is struggling to breathe, whether you're doing it this way or doing it that way. At a certain point, the lungs have a hard time getting enough air. So morphine slows the breathing process down, makes it very shallow, so you don't feel that stress of not having enough air. And by the end of the seventh day, the woman was sleeping very deeply, and I really don't know if it was from the morphine or from the dying process, because once you start giving people morphine, they get sleepy. I saw that with my father. And then very early, on her eighth day, her heart stopped beating, and she died. So 8 short days. I mean, it's just really a short process. When you think of sometimes people, you know, they may drag on in a suffering position for 10 years, 20 years, being incontinent, laying in bed, having dementia, Alzheimer's, in a miserable condition. And she decided, I'm going to avoid that. Now, it looked very peaceful from the outside. We don't know really what was going on from her perspective. I have had the experience working in a hospital that sometimes people, when they give them euthanasia, not euthanasia, but anesthesia, to go in under surgery for an amputation or for heart surgery, they are in medical coma, but they're totally awake and they feel everything. So the doctors are thinking, oh, they're looking very comfortable. I can saw away at them and stuff, and they wake up. I had one patient that woke up. She had had her legs both amputated in a car accident, and they, of course, the first thing they did is they took her to surgery and had to sew up her stump so she wouldn't bleed to death. And when she woke up, she said, oh my God, I was screaming. I was in medical coma. You paralyzed me to do this surgery, but I was fully awake. And I felt everything, if you can imagine. So, you know, this notion that it looks very peaceful from the outside, we don't know what a person's experience could be on the other side. So I was thinking, as I was watching this movie, of my godbrother, Kumar Rupa, who died not too long ago in Vrindavan. And he was a very caring cow protector. He had an ashram that would pick up cows and care for them. And he started for a few days. He didn't feel well. He got examined, and he had some kind of, I don't know, some cancer. I don't know if he had pancreatic cancer. He had something. And the devotees thought that he could be cured if he would just leave Vrindavan and go to a hospital. And he didn't want to leave Vrindavan, which is smart. You know, a lot of devotees figure, well, heck, I might live a few days longer, but better to die here. So he didn't want to go. And he just said, this is a good day as any day. Day will come. My death will come. So this is as good a day as anyway, any day. Native Americans also had that philosophy very often. If there was a battlefield or a war or something, this is the best day of any day because it's going to happen someday. And he asked the devotees to put pictures of him with cows, you know, because he loved his cows, and he wanted to remember himself in the mood of taking care of the cows in his cow sanctuary. And he laid down on his bed, and he stopped eating and drinking. And while the devotees were gathered around his bed, they chanted for him and gave him a wonderful send-off. I think it took the information I got was it took him about 4 or 5 days to leave his body, but I don't know if that's accurate. That's just what I'm talking about. So it's generally considered sinful for us to leave to end our life by artificial means, to, you know, with a drug overdose or shooting ourselves or jumping off a bridge, because that's usually due to a tamasic inspiration. A lot of people who try to commit suicide, they are hearing voices. They're delusional. And obviously they're not trying to think of Krishna. But I'm thinking, when I look at somebody like Kumarupa, and even in the Bhagavatam, when you read how Dhritarashtra and his wife Gandhari, they left home and they went to the forest and sat down to meditate and to fast, and they burnt up in a forest fire, or in the forest of the fire of realization. And so they made a choice also, at a certain time, I'm going to give up trying to support this body and just surrender my life to thinking of Krishna. Sometimes we see in Jainism, I got a scholarship while I was studying in the seminary to go and spend a whole summer with the Jains. They got me to India, and then I could go to Vrindavan, but they paid for the trip. So I went, and they showed us a lot of videos of this process of voluntarily stopping eating and drinking and to die. And it's similar to us, that they have people around who are chanting and singing, and they do it a little more gradually than this woman in the video did. That I told you about, a person may decide that in 8 years I'm going to do this thing. And so they practice. They start to practice eating less and taking less care of their body. And gradually, they get to a point where they stop eating altogether, and then finally they decide to stop drinking. And apparently it's the liquid, not having water, which is the big thing. You can live apparently a longer time with water, you actually need it to live. So they're supported through the whole process, and it's considered by them really a glorious thing. Not many people do it, but it's considered very glorious and righteous if a person can die in this way. Because they are able to fix their mind on the spiritual realm, and then they can enter into whatever they consider to be spiritual realm, which isn't really Krishna Loka. So I'm not advocating here, as I'm talking about, I'm telling you all this, that now we should all spend our lives this way. That is not our process. In fact, there's a good argument against doing that from a chaplain perspective, because, you know, even if when you can no longer contribute something materially, there's so much you can do on a spiritual platform. You know, there's no reason why you can't hear, even if you can't speak about Krishna. You can hear tapes, people can read to you. We have a god sister of mine living in New Dwarka since 5 years, and she is paralyzed pretty much from the neck down. I don't know if she has dementia or whatever. You can't really talk to her. Sometimes she says something coherent, sometimes not. Her children had her in some nursing home, and she was very depressed, even though she didn't apparently know where she was. And her children didn't want to take care of her. They were working and too busy. And so everybody gathered around thinking that she was going to die. And Savas, typically the temple president of Los Angeles Temple, has a policy that if you're within 6 months or a few months of your death, there are a few rooms you can stay in, and devotees will chant and help you as you leave your body. So they thought, well, she's going to die in just a couple of weeks. So he said, yeah, we'll give her a room. And she's still there. As soon as she came back to the temple, after being in a place where she wasn't hearing transcendental sound vibration, when she got to, they roll her into the temple and she could take darshan for whatever that was worth for her. And they had a little screen in her bed that she could, it was like 24/7 Prabhupada lectures and videos and stuff. And she perked right up, even though she wasn't able really to gain full access to her limbs and stuff. She was no longer depressed. And they say that just from being in the Association of Bodhis, she's so enlivened that every once in a while she'll say something coherent, like, hi, how are you? How are you, Paul? So that's a really wonderful thing about living with devotees and being surrounded. Not only that, people typically throughout their life, they've rendered an enormous amount of service to family members. You know, as a mother, as a grandparent, or as a even as a spouse or whatnot. And there's an opportunity when a person can no longer serve to give others the opportunity to serve them.
which is really hard for devotees. We you know, we're a little bit shy about receiving service. We don't feel like that we're worthy of getting service. But in some ways, there's a loving exchange that happens between the person serving and the person receiving service. So it deprives people, particularly your family, of growing, to make that spiritual growth of serving their parents or serving their loved ones, if they just decide to take a cocktail and end it. It's kind of a maturing process. If you don't die suddenly, if it's a gradual process, you get to say things to your family like, thank you very much, or I appreciated so much your life, I love you, or forgive me, I didn't mean to offend you in so many ways. It's a wonderful opportunity to clear that before you go to your next destination. So I'm going to stop here and see if there's any questions or comments or reflections about this very important topic. Leaving our bodies, yes.
Is euthanasia punishable by Vedic law?
Is euthanasia punishable by
Vedic law?
Vedic law, gosh, I don't know. Help us. Enlighten us. Is it?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, you
get what you pay for.
Yeah. Well, I guess what people are doing that often to avoid the purification that comes by moving through those stages of dying and disease. And I think there's a lot of realization that happens, especially the devotees I've been with who have been dying or have talked to. There's an enormous amount of advancement you make going through that process. So if you cut it short and you avoid that process,
you also become a ghost.
You can become a ghost, yeah. And that wouldn't be a very fun thing to do. Yeah. What else? Other thoughts?
Mm-hmm. It's good to hear that Los Angeles has a facility whereby devotees can spend their last time. Are there any other facilities around this kind of world?
Well, we have Vrindavan. You have that Vrindavan hospice. And I don't know all the temples. I mean, he doesn't call it a hospice. He just has a few guest rooms. He has, 5-star guest rooms that you pay for, and then he has some for people who are traveling, who don't require to pay. And so when somebody needs a room like that, he will delegate a room. But I think it's a really good idea that a temple has at least one place. Of course, as our movement grows, you may need many rooms as we get to that stage. But what I've noticed is sometimes people, when I've met people who are nearing death, my god sisters and god brothers, they've been in the hospital because there's a stage of an emergency first, and then they end up there in the hospital and it turns terminal, and they may be there for a week, a few days, and devotees come there. And what I've noticed with hospital staff is when they are aware that this person only has a very short time to live, they are very liberal in allowing people to come in. They notify family. One of my godbrothers died a few months ago in Washington, called Shradananda. I didn't know him personally, but they called me because I'm a chaplain. And funny, watching devotees around the bed, it's not much different than non-devotees, because they don't really know what to do. Obviously you can chant and hear and stuff, but people are sort of, what I noticed in this case, which was very odd to me, devotees are standing around talking to each other, like, hi, you hadn't seen each other in a while. Now they're standing there around the deathbed of their godbrother, which to me was not appropriate. But there's no education around that. Like, what should you be doing? Well, we should be chanting and hearing for that person as they leave their body. But devotees are uncomfortable still. They're uncomfortable. Like, what should I do? Don't even want to touch a person who's ill. I was surprised at that. Some are sitting on their cell phones and not at all connecting to what's happening in the room. And so I think it would be a great thing for us to have some education around that. What is the appropriate way to help a person leave their body? It's a very important task that we do for each other, to help each other leave and think of Krishna.
And also you mentioned about not eating and not drinking. Has anybody tried not breathing? That's a quick way.
I don't know if you can do that. Yeah, okay. You want to say more about that?
Well, if you stop breathing, you go unconscious and you stop breathing.
Yeah. I think organically you can't voluntarily stop breathing. There was a, when I was doing, I was studying at Virginia Commonwealth University to be a chaplain educator, and I met a nurse who whose mother wanted to end her life. And there's another movement, different than that kind of euthanasia movement, where they put a plastic bag over your head, and you have a pipe, and you can't do it for somebody else, but you can instruct them how to, and you know, what is it? Helium. They have to push the button, and they breathe helium, and like in 2 minutes, they're gone. And this woman, the nurse, said, my mother insisted that I organize that for her in the hospital. It sounds really gross. It doesn't sound like a very lovely way to die. And I think maybe it's possible that we over-dramatize what the dying process is as a devotee. If you do a little research on near-death experiences and people who have actually died and then came back, and who were theists who believed in the God, and those who weren't, it's very interesting. Even people who aren't Hare Krishna devotees, who are Christians, and they have even been atheists and even demons, you know, some of their description of their experience is they end up in a dark, damp space, and they don't know where they are. And out of nowhere comes these horrible, monster-like looking beings who try to tear their... they tear it, like our Yamadutas. I mean, they describe what is described in our books. And one fellow said, you know, out of nowhere, first these monsters were taunting me and mocking me and telling me horrible things and trying to bite my body and stuff. And out of nowhere came a voice that said, you know, call out God's name. And he thought to himself in that moment, in that dark place, I don't know how to do that. Only prayer I know is the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag. It said, I don't have anything because I've never been a devotee my whole life. But out of nowhere, he gets this some message that you need to call out God's name. So he thought, well, okay, I'll start chanting the Pledge of Allegiance because I know I already. So he starts doing that, and he starts to lift. His subtle body lifts out of that dark space. And he enters into another realm, and he says at that moment, he has an experience of another atmosphere, another being, which he would consider to be Jesus, who then guided him out of that space, and then he came back in his body. So I don't know where he would have gone, but if you look around, it's kind of interesting that everything people are experiencing is in our scripture, you know, that when we take shelter of Krishna our whole life, even if at the end of our life we can't think of Krishna because we're diseased or we have dementia or something, Krishna will think of us. And I think that the crossing over is probably not as scary as we think it might be for others, but still, our materialistic or conditioned part of ourself, our false ego, is definitely frightened. But I don't know if you can stop breathing and make that happen.
You stop breathing, you go into Kumbhaka, which will lengthen your life.
Like you do. Is it an Ayurvedic meditation or something?
Well, Kumbhaka is sometimes the yogis do that. They stop their heart rate.
Okay.
They're buried underneath the ground for like a month. When they come out, they live longer.
Well, that's a great thing. Can you show us how to do that? Have you done that?
Do you
know how to do it?
No.
It's funny because, you know, in this line of work, we're kind of like experts in dying. I mean, that's kind of what we do. You're all the time with dying people and stuff. But interestingly, in history, in America, they used to have, when they buried somebody, they would have a little hole in someone's coffin with a bell on top in case they woke up. Because sometimes people, they think they're dead and they're not. And so that's where the term comes, saved by the bell. You know, somebody wakes up, they're buried, they're already down, and they can ring, and there's somebody at the cemetery waiting so they can come and dig them up. Recently, actually, a few months ago, in California, at the I have typically been involved in the inner city Los Angeles University of Southern California Medical Center, but there's a hospital nearby called the Good Samaritan, and they were recently sued by a family who they had declared their mother had died, and they put her in a refrigerator. You know, they put them in a body bag and into a little refrigerator. And when they took the body out in order to bury her, they noticed that the body bag was open, and there were fingernail scratch marks on the top of the coffin, which means, or evidence, that she probably woke up and then really died of suffocation in the coffin. So they sued the hospital, like, oh, wait, you totally didn't diagnose this properly. So anyway, that's not going to happen. Anything else before we stop? Okay, let's see what she had.
You mentioned you were discussing the timelines around material work and then at the end of Kali Yuga, when religious principles reduced to zero, that marks the end of time in this world in that cycle. It just occurs to me, so I'm asking what your thinking is. Is it the material world is here as an opportunity for us to return back to Krishna? When that opportunity in the kind of religious principle reduces to zero, that's the significant thing.
Well, the significant thing is Kalki comes, because the only way we can be saved is by being killed by Krishna. So he comes as the Kalki avatar to destroy us so that we can have this one moment with God. And then I suspect there's another devastation thing. Perhaps you can explain it better than I am. I am able to. But it's described, you know, the process of flooding and devastation, where things become really hot, they burn up, and everything gets immersed, and then all life forms end, and then it lasts for a long time before it starts again. Right?
No.
Tell us.
At the end of Kali Yuga, there's still the devotees left.
Okay.
And Kali comes and annihilates the non-devotee.
Okay.
And then there's a slight danger where there's a purification. And then second devotee.
So there's no devastation. Final devastation.
There is eventually, but that's at the end of, as he says, Sahasri Yuga Pari and Kali Pari and Brahma Yuga.
Okay.
1,000 Yuga cycles in one day of Brahma.
Okay.
So then only after the day. There are slight devastations in between. The real devastations when Brahma goes to sleep.
Okay.
And it's after 1,000 Yuga cycles.
Okay, thank you very much. That was you got your answer. Thank you very much for enlightening us on that. That's very helpful. Does that answer your question?
I didn't express myself properly in doubt. My real question is, at the point in this material world where there's no hope of return for Krishna, is that mark of this material world as a functional entity?
There's no time where there is no hope.
There's no time. There is no hope.
Only when we go back into the body of Mahavishnu, then we can sleep for some time, for a long time.
So you seem to be asking that if there's a moment where it just all stops.
Where I was just saying that there is no time where there is no hope.
Oh.
Not, the material world is created. Given opportunity somehow.
Yeah.
But you know, even during the devastation, Markandeya Rishi was able to survive the devastation.
Mm.
And therefore he was, I guess he made some spiritual advancement. He found out what Maya was at least. So, but generally speaking, during the devastation, most of the entities are asleep. There's like a night when we're asleep. You generally don't make so much spiritual advancement.
Right.
But during when we're awake, there's always opportunity.
So it sounds like there's some hope. Does that make sense? Okay. Is there anything else? It's time for breakfast. No, right? What time do we have? We have a greeting or something.
Yeah, greeting.
Yeah, last question.
Do devotees be buried or cremated?
Well, typically we are cremated. Most devotees I know are cremated. Okay, let's go down. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.